This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. lawmakers at this hour are debating the objection to the state of Pennsylvania's electoral vote, hours after hundreds of pro-Trump protesters stormed the Capitol building, forcing lawmakers to seek shelter, interrupting the certification of Joe Biden's Electoral College victory. Since the proceedings resumed, the House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly to reject an objection to President-elect Biden's win in Arizona, joining the Senate in upholding the results of the election there. President Trump stirred up the protesters at a rally early Wednesday near the White House and later released a video on Twitter saying he loved them, urging them to go home, but not before his followers rushed the Capitol, some vandalizing the building. One woman was shot and killed. The circumstances of the shooting are being investigated. Washington's mayor declared a curfew until 6 a.m. this morning, and police in riot gear arrived to move the demonstrators away. President-elect Joe Biden condemned the protesters storming the Capitol building, calling the action an assault on the most sacred of America's undertakings, the doing of people's business. Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris will be sworn into office on January the 20th. World leaders expressed shock and condemned the chaos on the Capitol grounds and at the Capitol as pro-Trump members rioted the Capitol building. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson described the scenes at the U.S. Congress as disgraceful. The Japanese government said Thursday it hoped the U.S. would overcome the turmoil caused by the angry supporters of President Trump. For more news, join us at voanews.com via remote. This is VOA News. Facebook and Twitter reportedly suspended President Trump from their platforms Wednesday after his supporters stormed the Capitol. Twitter locked Trump out of his account for 12 hours and said that future violations, including repeating falsehoods about the integrity of the presidential election by Trump, could result in permanent suspension. Facebook and Instagram, which Facebook owns, followed up in the evening announcing that Trump wouldn't be able to post for 24 hours following two violations of its policies. The White House did not immediately offer a response to the actions. National Urban League President Marc Morial is among many urging lawmakers to invoke the 25th Amendment to remove President Trump from the White House in an effort to preserve democracy after Trump supporters rushed the Capitol. The 25th Amendment is enacted because Trump is deemed unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. At that point, the vice president would assume the powers of acting president. On the historic day of chaos at the Capitol, the Democrats were securing a majority in the U.S. Senate. The Associated Press declared Democrat John Ossoff the projected winner by defeating the incumbent Republican senator in his runoff race in the southern state of Georgia. He joins Reverend Raphael Warnock, who was declared winner of his Senate race, also in Georgia, defeating a second incumbent Republican Wednesday, giving their Democratic Party control of the U.S. Senate. The Democrats already controlled the House of Representatives. Their victories give Democrats full control of Congress, ensuring that President-elect Joe Biden and Democratic lawmakers can easily enact their legislative agenda as he takes office later this month. President-elect Biden is tapping Merrick Garland, a federal appellate judge whom Republicans snubbed for a seat on the Supreme Court in 2016, as the Attorney General to lead the country's Justice Department in his new administration, according to Biden's aides. If confirmed by the Senate, Garland will immediately face one politically sensitive case, a current criminal tax investigation into Biden's son, Hunter, as well as demands from some Democrats to pursue investigations into Trump's action as president after he leaves office in 2 weeks and is no longer immune from possible prosecution. As always, for details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com. Also, on the VOA mobile app. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Daily Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya says it has procured the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine.
I have explained that the first people that are going to be vaccinated on voluntary basis are essentially the healthcare workers, and other frontline actors being doctors, nurses, teachers, and so forth.
Malawi mandates COVID-19 quarantine for returnees from South Africa. Ugandan security released 13 suspected South Sudanese bandits. Ivory Coast opposition parties discuss merger ahead of March parliamentary elections. And the U.S. sees hope in Niger's election amid violence in Africa's Sahel region.
We have congratulated the people of Niger who exercised their democratic right to vote in their presidential and legislative elections on December 27th and look forward to observing an equally successful runoff presidential election process on February 21st.
And there were more testimonies Wednesday in Gambia's Truth, Reconciliation and Reparations Commission. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenyan government says it has procured 24 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine and that it is expected in the country by the second week of February. Health Cabinet Secretary Mutahi Kagwe said Wednesday that frontline workers and infected people will be the first groups to get the vaccine. In a related development, and as Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, county governments have taken a number of disciplinary measures on striking health workers.
It was a message of hope for Kenyans as Health Cabinet Secretary Mutahi Kagwe announced yesterday, Wednesday, that the government has procured 24 million doses of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, which he said will be arriving as early as February. Kagwe said that the ministry will give guidelines on how the vaccine would be administered, but first priority will be the frontline health workers, followed by teachers.
In the first 2 weeks of February, we expect the vaccine to be here. I have explained that the first people that are going to be vaccinated on voluntary basis are essentially the healthcare workers and other frontline actors being doctors, nurses, teachers, and so on and so forth.
Kagwe also stated that the private sector, among other entities, has been allowed to procure the COVID-19 vaccine in order to boost the government's batch of the vaccine.
There are three sources of vaccines. The first one is going to be the government order of vaccine that we have already placed as a Kenya government. The second one is going to be CDC Africa, which has also got a purchasing platform for vaccines that are going to be supplied, a system that has been organized by African countries, essentially through CDC in Addis Ababa. The third possible source of vaccines is going to be the private sector. As you know, AstraZeneca, which is the vaccine that we are going to introduce in Kenya, has also got private sector participants.
Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine is preferred over other approved vaccines because scientific reports indicate that it is easier to transport and it does not require special refrigerators to store. Kenya's total viral caseload now stands at 97,398 with 1,694 fatalities. In a related development, various counties have begun to implement a raft of disciplinary measures against striking health workers. Mombasa County yesterday, Wednesday, fired 86 out of 220 doctors from Mombasa County, including Kenya Medical Practitioners and Dentists Union Secretary General Dr. Shibanzi Mwachonda. However, the Doctors Union Coast Region Secretary General Dr. Abidan Mwachi says being fired will not stop them from fighting for their rights and that the county government must implement the return to work formula signed last year.
We sat down and crafted a return to work formula and we agreed both parties, they signed, we signed. They have totally rubbished that document, decided not to honor it, and instead they're running on a wrong different track, trying to lie to people, lie to everyone else, including themselves, and they believe their own life that they implemented it.
Kisumu County government has also started disciplinary action against 428 nurses by scraping them off the payroll and banning them from accessing their workstations. This comes a day after the Council of Governors rejected the return to work formula agreed upon and signed by the Ministry of Health and the Health Workers Union. The governors claimed they were not part of the formula. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
Thousands of Malawians have returned from South Africa in recent weeks, and officials fear they could import the new, more contagious form of the coronavirus. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi has seen a rapid increase of COVID-19 cases since the mid of December. The Public Health Institute of Malawi reports confirmed cases jumped from 116 on December 18 to 946 on January 5. Health authorities say they believe the rise is largely driven by Malawians who traveled to South Africa to look for work and escape poverty triggered by the pandemic. According to Malawi's Immigration Department, about 16,000 Malawians have returned from South Africa since the start of the pandemic, with others expected to return soon. Kumbizeka Dodochiponda is the Minister of Health.
40% of our cases has come from, especially our returnees from South Africa, and indeed our deportees. So we have no option but to put this mandatory institutionalized quarantine.
The new policy announced Tuesday says returnees will be taken to a quarantine facility for coronavirus testing. Those found to have the virus will not be allowed to return home until they test negative. Johnny Puga is the chairperson of the Presidential Task Force on COVID-19. He says the measure will help contain the more deadly new strain of the coronavirus, known as 501.V2, which has hit South Africa.
For the past 2 weeks, the number of cases had doubled almost twice. We were 210. We should have doubled to 400. We have now doubled again to over 800 active cases. So the rate at which this is rising is pointing towards that.
Puka notes that more young people are getting infected compared to the first wave of the pandemic.
In the current wave, amongst those that we have lost to death, three are less than 30 years. As we speak, we have two children that are admitted, for example, at Queen's. And then last week, we also discharged one child, 6 months old. So there are indications that we may have this variant.
This is not the first time Malawi has put returnees in quarantine. In May last year, more than 400 Malawian migrant workers who returned from South Africa escaped from a coronavirus screening camp at Kamuzu Stadium in the economic capital, Blantyre. This came 2 days after 8 people who tested positive for coronavirus escaped from Gamesa Isolation Center in Blantyre. This time, Health Minister Kandodo Chibonda says there will be very tight security in the quarantine facilities. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Recent violence in Mali, Niger, and the Central African Republic have left hundreds dead in recent weeks. But the United States envoy to the Sahel region says there is hope in the West African region, as several nations have recently held peaceful elections, with more elections to come in 2021. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The top U.S. envoy to Africa's Sahel region acknowledges that it has been a rough few weeks in the sprawling desert region, which covers the West African nations of Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger. The region is beset by a wave of deadly violence from extremist groups, with more than 1,000 violent incidents in the first half of 2020, according to a report from the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project. Most recently, in western Niger, extremists attacked 3 villages, killing more than 100 civilians. Peter Pham, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Sahel, strongly condemned the attacks in a call to journalists this week, calling the perpetrators cowardly and godless. But he quickly added, there is cause for hope as Niger heads to a second round of presidential elections in February.
We have congratulated the people of Niger who exercised their democratic right to vote in their presidential and legislative elections on December 27th and look forward to observing an equally successful runoff presidential election process on February 21st. These elections hold the promise of Niger's historic first peaceful transition of power from one democratically elected president to another.
It's no accident, Pham told journalists, that he mentions elections and instability in the same breath. That's because he contends that these outbreaks of violence across the region have one common cause.
The heart of the crisis in the Sahel, as I've repeatedly emphasized, is one of state legitimacy. whether or not citizens perceive that their government is legitimate, equitable, able and willing to meet their needs. This includes ensuring justice and accountability for human rights violations and abuses committed by security forces. Absent Sahelian government actions that demonstrate this commitment, no degree of international engagement is likely to succeed.
That's why he added the majority of U.S. government assistance to the region comes in the form of health, development, and humanitarian assistance. The U.S. has invested over $1.5 billion in those sectors from 2017 to 2019. In that same time period, he said, the U.S. provided about $467 million in security assistance. Ornella Moderan, a researcher who heads the Sahel program for the Institute for Security Studies, agrees on the importance of state legitimacy. She pointed to Mali, which had a coup in August because of this very lack of confidence in the state. But she said to truly build legitimate governments, societies have to come together voluntarily and have genuinely inclusive dialogue. She spoke to VOA via Skype from Bamako, Mali.
Now, the question I think is, to what extent can external actors like the U.S. actually support this and accompany this? There is a need for national ownership, and there's a need for dialogue, really, between ruling elites and common Malians. This is really the root cause of where we are right now. So it's important that while we're trying to reestablish a public dialogue, a national dialogue, that we make sure that everyone is included. And this means making sure that no ethnic groups are sidelined, no religious groups, no gender groups. And this is, of course, very challenging, but very important.
Is that happening? Maybe, said Fem, pointing to recent presidential elections in Ghana and Burkina Faso, where both incumbents were reelected. Fem was sent to both inaugurations as part of a U.S. presidential delegation. In both polls, the opposition cried foul, though the results were nevertheless certified. And both presidents have vowed to work for all citizens. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Batty in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 7th. Ugandan security personnel have released 13 suspected South Sudanese bandits. They were arrested last year by Ugandan Defense Forces for illegal entry and possession of firearms along the border districts of Lamwo and Kitgum. Ugandan authorities have asked officials in South Sudan to prosecute the suspects. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
The suspects reportedly entered Uganda more than 2 months ago to steal animals and other property. Security officials arrested them and found they had 4 guns, grenades, and 23 rounds of ammunition, among other items. The suspects have been in Ugandan detention centers, but a meeting of Ugandan and South Sudanese officials brought their release. William Komakech is the Kitgum Resident District Commissioner. He led the Ugandan delegation to the meeting.
There has been several incidences along the border. We have lost life. We have lost properties, ranging from animals to household property. So to me, I am glad that today we are meeting. It should set a milestone in our life. If us as Uganda, with all the means, would preserve the lives of the 13 people, why should they come and kill us? The killing should stop. The looting should stop today. We are one people. If you go to the border here, you find one man as a woman on the other side and another woman this side. Why should we really kill ourselves?
Brigadier William Bainomugisha is the commander of the 5th Infantry Division of the Uganda People's Defense Force. He called on South Sudan authorities to disarm their nationals.
We disarm nobody. Nobody should support card any, especially the gun. But on our side, they are able to cross with the guns and what, and when they are not a government, not the soldier or even the police.
Alphonse Muraz is a member of parliament in South Sudan's Eastern Equatorial State. He blames the repeated infiltration of South Sudanese into Uganda on the continued conflict at home.
When our people are in conflict, down at the grassroots, they also take opportunity of entering anywhere they want because there's no control. The focus now is all trying to solve this conflict which is in South Sudan. That's why Uganda is part of it, trying to solve the issue of South Sudan. And we have been appreciating the effort that Uganda is doing. And we still continue asking Uganda to support us to bring peace in South Sudan. I think if South Sudan attain peace, the way you Ugandan have peace, I think all the efforts will be implemented.
Auxilio Odum, also with the South Sudan team, says there needs to be a continued dialogue on how to eliminate the intrusions.
I want to apologize on behalf of the government of Eastern Equatorial State. Sorry, Malice, forgive us. And we thank you for having kept them alive, sound, and healthy. South Sudan, in particular, he is focusing now on peace. And he's working very hard to ensure that peace is attained in the country. That is why we accept to always come for dialogue. We will not accept any other means that does not bring peace between the two countries.
Alberio Tabilio Oromo is the former governor of Tarit State in South Sudan. He said all the suspects will be brought to court, but prosecutors need to have the guns back to use as evidence.
Case will be opened against them of crossing the border with the firearms and all this, and then they will be produced to court of law. Now, the lawyer will say, where is the evidence? We need the evidence. Where is the guns? And then there, they will be released. And when they are released, they will go and make it again.
Ugandan authorities say the firearms will not be returned for security reasons and that they are undertaking forensic investigations. The porous boundary between the two countries has seen a growing influx of armed men from South Sudan into Uganda's border districts of Lamu and Kitgum. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
In Ivory Coast, two factions of former President Laurent Gbagbo's Ivorian Popular Front Party, the FPI, have been discussing coming together under one banner ahead of the March legislative elections. The Gbagbo faction and that of acting FPI President Pascal Affi N'Guessan are discussing coming together in the spirit of reconciliation. Isiaka Sangare is Secretary General and spokesperson of the party. He says a coalition with other opposition parties will lead to fielding unified candidates and win as many seats as possible against President Alassane Ouattara's ruling party.
Our political party, which is the FPI, the Ivorian Popular Front, and most of the political parties from the opposition side that were united in a platform decide to go to those elections.
How true is it, Isiaka, that there is a merger, that there's a discussion going on between your party for a merger?
Yeah, we have decided to go for a merger because, as we saw for the presidential election, the situation was very good for us. We didn't participate, but we saw with the rate of participation that most of the people were waiting for the opposition side to run for those elections. So for now, we have decided all together in that platform, which united most of the important political party from the opposition to go together. For now, we're going on with the discussion, but we think that in a few days, maybe January the 14th, we'll be ready to show the first list. For us, it is very important because you have to return back in the institutional activities. And with that, those elections, the situation will be better for us. Because we think that how the situation is, most of the representative of the vote will be for our political parties. So we decide to go together, to be united, and then to create a synergy so that we can support only one candidate from the opposition side.
What happens, Isiaka, because some of your critics say that the opposition have protested and were making demands, for example, an electoral commission that is fairly represented, also the financing of candidates. Now, they say that you did not get any of these, but yet you have agreed to go to the election. What's your answer?
The first thing for us was to get an equality in the election commission. And we get a few acts that have been accepted in that opposition, in that dialogue. So for now, the PDC, which is one of the opposition side political party, will get a representative in that commission. And it will be the same thing for another political party, which is the ADS. They'll get also someone to represent him in the commission's board. So we think that those situations can give us the opportunity to go in those elections because there will be a new election for the representative of the political parties in the central commission. For the financial, we asked for this, but for now, this demand wasn't agreed. Anyway, we do the best we can so that we know that people is waiting for us to run for those elections. So we're going to do the best to get more, a lot of deputies there.
Under the discussion going on for the merger, will you have single candidates representing the coalition, or would you have separate candidates?
We're looking forward to have a unique candidate. This is our aim, and that's why I say that the discussion is going on. We have a few more days to see how the situation will be. You know, in those situations, most of the people want to run, but it will be important for us to get a unique candidate for the opposition side in different, you know, cities. That's the way we want things to be. But you know, everything is discussion. Most of the political party for now, we have a few meetings. We had a meeting today, and maybe tomorrow we'll have a declaration about our agreement to go together for those elections.
What about women, representation of women? I think the requirement, one of the requirements for the parliamentary election is that to present a minimum of 30% of female candidates. Are you recruiting women?
Yeah, 30% of female candidates. Yeah, we have to do it. Most of the political party, it's the law now. It's no more a recommendation. It's a law. So we have to do this, and we think that this is a good approach. We agree with such an approach. So all our list will get some women inside. We have to look for, to recruit maybe 30% of women. And our political party has no problem with this.
Isiya Kasangari is the Secretary General and spokesperson of former Ivorian President Laurent Gbagbo's party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abidjan. The chairman of Gambia's Truth, Reconciliation and Reparations Commission has called on the country's intelligence chief to open up and tell the commission what he knows about former President Yahya Jammeh's rule. This followed the witness's hours-long testimony before the commission on Wednesday. Reporter Pandera Umbai has been following this story and reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
But it's also common knowledge that the NIA was also involved in drug deals. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
Well, I want to believe that you don't believe that answer.
My own answer.
Usman Sow, the Director General of the State Intelligence Services, SIS, formerly known as the National Intelligence Agency, being led in evidence by lead counsel SFA. So has served in various positions at the NIA before the change of government in December of 2016. He has denied having knowledge of NIA agents being engaged in drug trafficking.
The NIA has continually been accused, or NIA staff have continually been accused of being involved in drugs. In fact, Mr. Witness, there has been a lot of schemes going on at the NIA. One scheme was you set up somebody up, catch the person with drugs, another NIA team would come, the drug dealer would run away, the NIA guys would make away with the drugs.
Lead counsel SFL has also queried the excesses at the NIA during Jammeh's rule. The agency has been accused of torture and kidnapping of government opponents. Fall said the NIA has been undercutting security agencies that have been empowered to handle drug-related investigations.
My point is, the NIA should not, must not, ought not to be in the lead of dealing with or operational activities for drug trafficking. You agree?
Yes.
You agree?
That's
it. Finally.
The chairman of the commission, Dr. Lamine Cisse, wasn't happy with the pace of the witness testimony.
We had spent hours and hours, almost on counsel explaining something, and witness saying, yes, I agree. I was in response to counsel some question, do you agree or you don't agree? Yes, I agree. No information is given to us for the record. It's not the counsel who is testifying here. At one point, I was comparing it to a football game. Manchester United possession, 75%. Manchester City, 15-20%.
For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
And that's it for this Thursday, January 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barty in Washington, hoping that you will have a very good day.